I think the old doggerel puts it pretty well, really. The devil was fairly voted out, and of course the devil's gone, but simple folk would like to know, who carries his business on? I mean, talk of a personal devil will raise a patronising smile these days, a mocking laugh if you imagine horns and a tail. And yet, the idea of an ultimate force of evil is not so far-fetched when we think of our world, is it? I mean, from the very personal level, not those days when you are grumpy and rebellious, but the other ones, when you want to make it work, when you want to give yourself to those around you, when you want to be good, and it all goes sour, and you go sour, and where did those ugly ideas and thoughts and behaviours come from? You know, the red mist that meant I lost it. The words that came out so cruelly cutting. You can believe in human sinfulness and responsibility as the Bible does and still wonder about a force of evil outside of us. Now, why do well-meaning institutions get blind to their own deceit? Why do communities find themselves trapped in a web of violence which they know is pointless? Why does a PhD student near the top of the academic tree a couple of years back walk into a cinema and calmly gun down 12 people and injure more than 50 others, as he did the other night in America? Why did Kerry Fuller knife to death his three children aged 7, 8 and 12 and then throw himself off a cliff last week? His father-in-law doesn't know. He wrote this remarkable open letter the other day. Perhaps some of you feel anger towards Kerry. You know him only as the man who did this. I know him as the man who fell in love with my daughter. I know him as the man who worked tirelessly to support the family he worshipped. I know him as the man who, together with my daughter, raised my beautiful grandchildren in an environment of love and joy and laughter. Perhaps we'll never understand the torment in Kerry's mind that drove him to such an act, but I know this was not an act of malice or spite. I weep for my daughter's pain, I weep for the loss of my grandchildren, and I weep for Kerry's pain and confusion. He will always remain a man I am proud to have called my son-in-law. Remarkable words, aren't they? So why did he do it? The devil? Satan, the serpent of the early chapters of Genesis with his insidious ideas of evil, still seems very much a going concern. Business seems good for him still. No doubt smirking happily as we dismiss fanciful caricatures and remain blind to his manipulative scheming. Where does Satan come from? That's the popular question, isn't it? It's not ours today. In Revelation, John is handling the opposite question. He's grappling with the reality of the forces of evil. And he faces up to that other question, where is Satan heading for? It's actually a vital question. There's no future worth having without an answer to that, first of all. Paint as idyllic a utopia as you like. It's just in your dreams, so long as this Satan's on the loose. Well, John tells us at the beginning of the book, he's been given a glimpse of what is now and what will come later, and he tells us both of those today. What is now, as he takes us behind the scenes, so to speak, to explain that life, as so often, isn't just as it looks on the surface. And what is to come later, as he shows us Satan's destiny and ours. So, pull back the curtains with me and come through to what I've called behind the scenes. And we'll begin in the snake pit in verses 1 to 3. See, as the chapter opens, John's being shown something we wouldn't know if he hadn't told us, and something he wouldn't have known if he hadn't been shown it. And I saw an angel, he writes, coming down out of heaven, having the key to the abyss and holding in his hand a great chain. He seized the dragon, that ancient serpent, who is the devil or Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years. He threw him into the abyss and locked and sealed it over him to keep him from deceiving the nations anymore until the 1,000 years were ended. And after that, he must be set free for a short time. Now, never mind the difficult bits. Did you get the main point? Did you see the big thrust? Satan is chained, bound, limited. Can you think of any other mention of Satan being bound in the New Testament? Quick minds, remember, Jesus spoke about that, didn't he? Matthew, Mark, and Luke all record it. Miracles are happening frequently as his ministry starts up. A demon-possessed man who is blind and mute is healed, sees, speaks. So speculation starts up. The rumor mill churns away the way it does. Could this be the son of David? Is this Messiah? And the Pharisees, the religious establishment of the day, they'll have none of it. They think Jesus is demon-possessed. That's how he casts out demons. And you can almost hear Jesus spluttering into his coffee. "I've heard some crazy ideas in my time," he says. Well, it's not quite what the Greek says, but it's the spirit of it. You know, that's a recipe for civil war and disaster for Satan if he's attacking his own side. Makes no sense at all. "I've got a better idea." And Jesus says this: "If it's by the Spirit of God that I drive out demons, then the kingdom of God has come upon you." Or again, how can anyone enter a strong man's house and carry off his possessions unless he first ties up the strong man? Then he can plunder his house. Unless he first ties up the strong man. And that word for ties up is exactly the same as John uses here in verse 2 for bound. When Jesus came, Satan was bound. At Calvary, he was disarmed and chained. In other words, when we get to Revelation 20, I don't think we've got a chronological sequel to chapter 19 with yet another attack and yet another final battle. I think chapter 20 is John doing what he's done all the way through this book, taking a deep breath, stepping back and saying, "Look, let's look at this again from a different angle," and launching into another panoramic sweep across the history of the gospel age. Oh, I know it speaks of 1,000 years, and here we are in 2012 AD, but when it comes to numbers and figures in Revelation, how can we take them literally? They're almost all symbolic. What's actually far harder for many of us to get our heads around is the idea that Satan is chained now. He seems far too active. And most of our objections are probably nothing compared to the questions John's readers could ask. Pull the other one, you can almost hear them saying, "Christians swatted off like flies as persecution breaks out. John himself bound to a penal colony." Satan chained, don't make me laugh. But that is just the point. Of course it doesn't look like it. Of course I can't work it out for myself. That's why John had to be shown it. It wouldn't occur to me as I watch the drama of the sufferings of the church today to think that the serpent sort of orchestrating and manipulating them all was operating off a chain securely fixed and tethered. So John is taken behind the scenes. And he shows it to us. It's almost as if he picks up the chain and says, "Do you see it?" Now, don't misunderstand me. Of course, these verses aren't the whole story. John doesn't see everything in any one picture. Of course, Satan is active. This book's been full of his activity. But this picture shows what Satan cannot do. Did you spot it there in verse 3? He's bound to keep him from deceiving the nations anymore. That's the purpose of the chain, the only one mentioned. That's the limit on Satan, the only one mentioned. The coming of Christ has broken the ignorance of the nations about God. See, before Christ, what confident, realistic hope did they have of forgiveness from a holy God? Before Christ, what confident, realistic hope did they have of immortality, a life beyond the grave based on fact, not myth? And when Jesus comes, and you remember him, the baby picked up into Simeon's arms in the temple, and what does Simeon say of him? A light to lighten the nations. And as he grows up and his public ministry starts, Greeks come to his disciples and say, "Sir, we would see Jesus." Roman centurions come to him, Samaritan woman. When you get to the book of Acts, the gospel, the good news of Jesus goes from Jerusalem to Rome to the ends of the earth. And ever since, with its ups and its downs, its ebbs and its flows, the gospel has been inexorably spreading around the world. I mean, again, see what happens when Satan is loosed. Down there in verse 8, he will go out to deceive the nations and to gather them for battle. But he hasn't done that yet. When he is loosed, he'll bring in the end, but he hasn't managed it yet. The chains have been effective, and the end is in God's control, not Satan's. You see, as I go behind the scenes, I begin to discover that Satan is dangerous, but he's bound. When our kids were young, we sometimes went for a little outing to Colchester Zoo, not the greatest zoo in the world, but it had plenty to amuse and entertain them. And I can remember vividly late one afternoon taking them along to see lion feeding time. And, you know, I got them with me. I think I got one up on my shoulders. And we were the a queue of others sort of watching the lions, a couple of them padding rather sleepily up and down their enclosure. And suddenly, halfway back, one of the lions suddenly turned, reared up to the fence and roared. And everyone stepped back. You know, I grabbed the kid on my shoulders to make sure he didn't fall off. We were perfectly safe, actually. I mean, the fence was 15, 20 foot high, and we were another 5 foot back behind a metal rail. But suddenly you were reminded that this lion was dangerous, even if it was limited. Well, Satan is like that. He can't destroy the church. I mean, whatever he gets up to, he can hurt it, he can damage it, he can martyr it, sure. He can't destroy the church. I read a very striking article in the Times yesterday about the church in Iran. They just carried this big report on it and some of the persecution that Christians are facing there. Let me read you a bit of it. The experience of Mojdi is fairly typical. She was forced to choose in court between her faith and her 2.5-year-old daughter when her husband, a Muslim, divorced her. The judge told me, "There's only one way you can take custody of your daughter. If you come back to Islam and recant your Christian faith, we will give you your daughter." Her lawyer urged her to agree, but Mojdi stood firm. "I told the judge that I would never deny Jesus. So the court ruled in favor of my husband and took my daughter away from me." A well-informed observer says this: "When people come to faith in Iran and go to a church and the authorities find out, they frighten these new Christians by bringing them in for questioning. They're blindfolded on the way to the interrogation center and are threatened to make them recant and to sign documents saying they'll not take part in any further Christian activity. And the authorities try to fill in the jigsaw by asking for the names of all the Christians they know." And yet the article goes on, "Despite all of this, estimates now put the number of new Christians in Iran at more than 500,000. A far cry from 1979, the year of the Iranian Revolution, when there were fewer than 500 known Christians from a Muslim background in Iran." Oh yes, he's dangerous. Oh yes, he's active. Oh, yes, he can damage. Oh, yes, he can hurt. But he can't destroy the church. Or come to this second behind-the-scenes scene. As we look on the thrones in verses 4 to 6. See, it's one thing to talk about the chain from the safety of All Souls Langham Place. Quite another to write this as John was to those who would ask, "What about my friend? He stayed true to Christ. Where has it got them and their family? I mean, martyred, dead, we're next. Is the chain really any use?" Well, look at verse 4. "I saw thrones." He takes us into the throne room. He shows us people reigning for 1,000 years. All the time Satan is chained up, these are reigning. And why is John shown the thrones? Because you can't see them normally. They're in heaven. And who's on them? Well, look at verse 4. The souls of those who'd been beheaded because of their testimony about Jesus and because of the word of God, they had not worshipped the beast or its image. They'd not received its mark on their foreheads and their hands. I mean, they're Christians, aren't they? Christian martyrs. Though then as now, there were places where you weren't likely to come to any other end if you refused to sell out to the powers of evil as these refused in staying true to Jesus. But do you see how encouraging this chapter is? John has got this entry all areas pass, and he's whisked us behind the scenes where everything looks different. The snake is there, but operating off a secure chain. The believers are martyred, but they're enthroned as well. Reigning in heaven when we just thought of them as dead. This is, verse 5, the first resurrection. I think that probably begins with our conversion when we're raised with Christ. And this picture certainly echoes the thoughts of Paul. You remember when he wrote to the Corinthians in 1 Corinthians 6, urging them not to go to the law courts against each other? Because why have the ungodly decide a case when, as he put it, the Lord's people will judge the world? But he says, I don't really need to worry about first resurrection people. Save my worries for the rest of the dead, as he describes them. This is a great encouragement for first resurrection people when we're full of despair for them. See, I see Christian brothers and sisters faithful, true to Jesus, yet humiliated. I'm asking why? Why him? Why her? She was so good. He was so Christian. This is so awful and unfair. And verse 6 reminds me, blessed, happy, lucky people, holier those who share in the first resurrection. The second death has no power over them. The second death is the place of judgment, as we'll see. See, if you've got a backstage pass, it changes our view of reality. Satan, so powerful, so dangerous, yes, yet tethered. Believers, so humiliated, so abused, yes, yet reigning. Blessed. We're good at that second one in theory, aren't we? It's just I find most Christians struggle when it gets personal and it's someone we know. I'll need to readjust my thinking to what God's showing me. Well, hold on to those truths, because we're going to head to the future in the rest of this chapter and to what will one day be in full view. And it begins with the last battle, verses 7 to 10. And if you've been following us through the book, we've seen hints of this all the way through. A last desperate, convulsive death throw of the snake. And in verse 7, he's unfettered. Satan will be released. In verse 8, the rebellion's international. He'll go out to deceive the nations in the four corners of the earth to gather them for battle. Globalization that's here in so many ways, it doesn't just affect economics, does it? It affects values. From MTV to the internet via aid with strings attached, we move for good or ill more and more towards, you know, the whole world thinks, or at least talking about how the whole world should think. And verses 8 and 9, they're overwhelmingly hostile. In number, they're like sand on the seashore. By the way, do you remember God's promise to Abraham back in those early chapters of Genesis about how all peoples on earth will be blessed through you? And as for descendants, Abraham, who didn't even have one kid, was told, look up at the sky, count the stars, if indeed you can count them. He wasn't in anywhere like London with all its light pollution. Yet that's how many. Well, here's Satan once again with his plastic imitation. And verse 9, they marched across the breadth of the earth. They surrounded the camp of God's people, the city he loves, implacably hostile. You can't barter or negotiate. Underneath it all, they want God's people destroyed, not just in a minority, not just sidelined, not just keeping their views to themselves. An American bishop who stood out against an overwhelming tide of muddled and wrong thinking at the recent General Convention, said this last week. He said, "People say to me, Bishop, the culture is accepting this. To continue to resist these innovations is to put ourselves on the wrong side of history." I say, the bishop went on, "You cannot be on the wrong side of history if you're on the right side of reality." The wrong side of history. But look where history ends, verse 9. "But fire came down from heaven and devoured them." I mean, you don't want to be on their side of history then, do you? And Armageddon once again proves to be a damp squib. And whatever angle you look at it from. It's always presented to us, isn't it, as the battle to end all battles. Looks as if it ought to be, but every time it doesn't turn out like that at all. I mean, watch the replays if you don't believe me. Read the three accounts Revelation gives us, chapters 16, 19, 20. Every time it's no contest. But do you see what God's saying to us? Don't bite your fingernails wondering who's going to win. Don't lose sleep wondering which side to back. Calvary, which disarmed the powers and authorities, wasn't Satan having an off day? You know, perhaps he'll win the return bout. No, it revealed the truth. It sealed his fate. It showed he's not in the same league. Look, verse 10. The devil, who deceived them, was thrown into the lake of burning sulfur where the beast and the false prophet had been thrown. They'll be tormented day and night forever and ever. The first two chapters of the Bible, remember, Genesis 1 and 2, tell of the world God made, and it was very good. And there's not a mention of Satan or his activities in a single verse of them. Satan appears in Genesis 3, and the rest of the Bible speaks of the damage he causes and the rescue God provides until Satan's ultimate defeat here. So that the last two chapters of the Bible, just like the first two, speak of a world God makes, a new heaven and a new earth. It's better than very good. And once again, there's not a trace of Satan or any of his minions in it. And as if to emphasize that point, and before we get to it, John sees one last picture, not so much the last battle, more the final judgment. Now, there's no doubt what's going on here in verses 11 to 15. I mean, everything is being wound up, isn't it? Look, verse 11. "Then I saw a great white throne, and him who was seated on it, God, in control as he has been all along. And the earth and the heavens, the sky as we'd call it, fled from his presence. There was no place for them." Look, when it comes to speaking of the eternal future and God's new creation, the New Testament speaks both in terms of continuity and discontinuity. Continuity, as in Romans chapter 8, and creation groaning and waiting for a liberation, and spirit-filled believers groaning as we wait for the redemption of our bodies. Continuity in that something of the now will be there then. But here it speaks of discontinuity. The Bible's got lessons for us in both, and we Christians sometimes only seem to have ears for one. The new creation is not simply this one renewed, but radically transformed. Not just our old ways and habits and achievements with a bit of extra polish on them. Certainly not a whole new world with an effortless, seamless transition into it. Look at verse 12. "And I saw the dead, great and small, standing before the throne, and books were opened, and another book was opened, which is the book of life, and the dead were judged according to what they'd done, as recorded in the books. And the sea gave up the dead that were in it, and death and Hades gave up the dead that were in them, and each person was judged according to what they'd done." No one is left out in this judgment scene. The great and the small are there, as we saw last week. The living and the dead, the past as well as the present. Death is not an escape from judgment. Sir Alistair Burnett, the journalist and newscaster, died on Friday here. He always used to end ITV's News at 10 with some quirky, humorous item that he would introduce by saying, "And finally." The Times, reporting his death, carried a cartoon of a tombstone, and on it they had written, "Sir Alistair Burnett," and then underneath, "And finally." Only it isn't. He still has this to come. I mean, we can speak and think very carelessly at the graveside, can't we? "Rest in peace," we write. "At last he, she's at peace now," we say. But this is still to come. It's why some deaths are so painful for us. We know we've only laid our friend to rest until this day, and we fear for them then. It's a fear that should give us urgency to speak while friends are still living. Then verse 14, death and Hades were thrown into the lake of fire. The lake of fire is the second death. There's no comeback from there. And the fact that death and Hades are there is one reason why John will speak of a future hope that is so sure and bright and confident, where life does not get ended and relationships fractured and living become pain-ridden. A world where, in the words of verse 4 of chapter 21, there will be no more death, or mourning, or crying, or pain. Of course not, for the old order of things has passed away. But for now, John's facing us with the greatest challenge of them all. How to get from this world to that? Verse 15, anyone whose name was not written in the book of life was thrown into the lake of fire. See, those books, I mean, what a picture they present. It's a bit like end-of-term reports. Do you remember getting yours? I can remember mine. I had to take home in a sealed envelope. I gave them to my mum, but it all had to wait till my dad got home from work, and he would open them and read them with a poker face, and then I'd discover the verdict. Yeah, those books are all my deeds, minuted and looked up, and it's going to be fair and just, too fair and just, to be honest. Everything I've done, you've done, logged, recorded, unedited, unexpurgated, the official biography. There's no hope for me in front of a holy God in those books. Hope lies in the other book, the book of life. The book of those Jesus has saved. The book of those for whom his death on the cross has effected forgiveness and pardon and life. The book of those who've turned to the Jesus who said, "I am the life," who've embraced him and trusted him and thrown themselves on his mercy. That's whose names are in the book of life. Is yours one of them? Is yours one of them? I had to go to Buckingham Palace on Friday. I mean, not to have an audience with Her Majesty, just to pick up a little box from someone who works there. But I had fun as I went along. I came up to the gates. You know, the tourists are all there, and they're having pictures of themselves taken next to the policeman on duty. And when one group had finished, I just sort of came up to him and said, "Excuse me, I'm here to pick something up at the palace. And you know, what's your name?" And I said what my name was, and his colleague got his clipboard out. And there was a worrying pause as he worked his way down the clipboard. But finally he said, "Mr. Palmer, yes, you were there. I was on the list." And that was the key. You know, I was waved through into the court. You know, that great courtyard at Buckingham Palace. And there wasn't a person on it apart from the sentries up at the far wall. And, you know, as the tourists looked on with their cameras clicking, I just strolled across the courtyard. You know, I entered this whole new world as I went up the steps. And if the truth be told, in a side entrance and a waiting room, which was as far as I got. Yeah, and coming back, as I swept through the gates, I heard one tourist kneel to his little boy and explain to him, "That's a very important person. He's been in with the Queen." I thought as I walked by, little do you know. But I didn't say a word to spoil it for the boy, you know. I just straightened my back and strode on as importantly as I could. Look, as this chapter ends, a whole new world is about to come into being. And you can stride in. And you can savor it. You can go up the main entrance. You can enjoy it, every wonderful bit of it. And this time you will be face to face with the ultimate royalty, provided your name is on the list. The book of life, when the names are read out, will yours be there? Well, here's the cry that puts it there. The cry that's at the heart of our last hymn. Jesus is Lord. Let's stand and sing of him.